had been so busy convincing her that she was dumb that he believed it too. And yet she had been able to get away from him by leaving without really leaving. When he finally caught on that he was seeing her less and less, he panicked. Unlike the other women he had let go, he was obsessed with getting Dana back. She was many things to him. She was a meal ticket. She was young, sexy, and extremely beautiful. And she knew things about him that he never wanted her to tell. Brad wasn't finished with Dana, nor was he finished with Sarah. He still needed them both, for different reasons. He had told Sarah that he detested her, but he wanted her to stay healthy so he could sue her for child support. He had really been scrambling for money. He had sold the little rental house in Tampico, the house he always referred to as the boys' house, and collected a $40,000 balloon payment. They never saw the money. Brad bought a truck and trailer with it and a Macintosh computer. On February 23, 1993, he kept his promise to seek child support from Sarah by filing a motion in Multnomah County Circuit Court. In his affidavit, Brad said he was unemployed while Sarah earned about $350,000 a year. He stated that he was the full-time primary care parent of his sons and was commuting to Yakima, Washington to work on the family home. No mention was made of the mountain of debts he had saddled Sarah with when they divorced. District Attorney Scott Upham and his investigators in Washington County were getting antsy. They were more so when they learned from Greg Dallaire at Garvey Schubert that Judge Sharon Armstrong had received a surprise phone call from Dana Malloy. Mike McKernan called Dana and learned that Brad was getting ready to vanish. On March 16, 1993, Brad had gone to Dana's house in a rage and accused her of talking to the Oregon State Police. He told her that she had betrayed him, and now he was about to be indicted on murder charges. Jess and Michael had been subpoenaed to appear before the Washington County Grand Jury, and Brad was in a panic. "You can mess with me, but don't mess with my kids," he warned. He told Dana that he would never, never allow his sons to testify before a grand jury again. Dana had been frightened enough to call the Seattle police to have Brad removed from her premises. Then, on Sunday, March 21st, Brad had called Dana and talked to her for 2 hours. He told her that before he allowed his children to go to Oregon to testify before the grand jury, he would leave the country. His voice softened, and he urged her to come back to him. She could go with them when they fled America. They would be together, just like old times. Dana told McKernan she knew that Brad had done thorough research on both Mexico and Chile by going to the library and by talking to people who had lived there. This wasn't something new. Fleeing the country had long been his alternative plan if he ever felt pushed to the wall. Brad had had passports for himself and the boys since May of 1990. Now he told Dana that he planned to take Jess, Michael, and Philip to Chile. He had already arranged for them to live with a Chilean family. Dana was ambivalent. Part of her still loved Brad, the other part was afraid of him. She told him that she couldn't be with him because of what had happened to Cheryl. Brad said he wasn't the one who had killed Cheryl. He personally believed that the killer was probably someone from Garvey Schubert, one of the men Brad claimed Cheryl was sleeping with. "I was going to depose this guy in our divorce," he said, "and his wife would have found out, and then he would have gotten divorced, and it would have cost him a lot of money." "I want to know, Brad," Dana pleaded. "I want you to make me believe you didn't kill Cheryl." Brad was quite willing to do that. As Dana later told Mike McKernan, he said he was home with his sons all night, and the only time he left was to do laundry and to put something in his car. "I wasn't gone long enough for them to say I did it." Brad went into greater detail with Dana than he had with anyone else, adding the information that The police never found blood under my nails. He talked on and on, certain he was convincing her that he was safe to be with. He told her that Cheryl was involved with cocaine and that she used cocaine with people in her law firm. Maybe someone into drugs killed Cheryl Keaton, he said. As Dana listened, Brad became more and more specific about names involved in the investigation of Cheryl's murder. She suddenly recalled seeing the name Sharon Armstrong in some police files Brad had once shown her, and she asked him how Judge Armstrong fit into the picture of Cheryl's murder. Brad was instantly upset. He said she must be hiding something from him, and he accused her of talking to Judge Armstrong. Dana hadn't talked to Sharon Armstrong, but now she wanted to. She scribbled that name down as Brad continued to talk. He told her he couldn't let his kids go before a grand jury because it would ruin them, and he asked her again to go with him when they left America. If you don't go with me when I leave, Dana, there will be an apocalypse and I won't be around to be indicted. Dana was beginning to believe that Brad really was going. He had always told her in the past that if he had to leave, she would know because he would turn off his voicemail. Now he said, I have brought you my last gift, and I'm turning off my voicemail. He did not go. He continued to harass Dana, creeping up to her house late at night and banging on her walls. He shouted at her, I want all the information you have, Dana. And he attached another listening device to her phone, recording her calls. It may well have been that he wanted his angel dead. And it's just as likely that he was still obsessed with her sexually. He always wanted me back, Dana recalled, bewildered. He was very jealous. He phoned me so often in those first months of 1993. He told me that he had consulted a psychic. He said the psychic told him that four men had killed Cheryl, and then the psychic said that I was going to commit suicide. Dana shivered when she repeated that phrase to Mike McKernan. She knew what it meant. He thought he had enough power over her mind to make her take her own life. Brad had always been able to persuade her to do things she didn't really want to do. It would be very convenient for him now if she did commit suicide. Then he could be sure she would never testify before the grand jury in Hillsboro. But Dana had become obsessed with knowing the truth. She located Judge Sharon Armstrong's number and called her, identifying herself as a former girlfriend of Brad's. Not surprisingly, Sharon was disturbed to hear from anyone connected with Brad. Dana confided that she had information about Brad, but that she was frightened. He could have killed me if I came forward. Dana had trusted Sharon enough to leave two phone numbers with her, and Sharon had passed them on to OSP Detective Mike McKernan. The world was closing in around Brad. McKernan was working closely with DA Scott Upham's office, helping to tighten the net. It was true that the Washington County Grand Jury wanted to hear the testimony from Jess and Michael Cunningham. On March 12th, the subpoena documents were sent to the Snohomish County Prosecutor's Office in Everett, Washington, ordering that Bradley Morris Cunningham be compelled to produce Jess and Michael before the Washington County Grand Jury on March 25th. Snohomish County authorities were hopeful that they could get Brad to come to the courthouse in Everett voluntarily with his sons so they might be served. He responded by saying that he had hired an attorney for his children. McKernan asked to be notified about any hearings in Snohomish County where Brad was expected to appear. He advised the Washington authorities of Dr. Herman Dreesen's address. When contacted, Dreesen said it would be up to Brad to bring the children in. He would not override his nephew's decisions. As he always had, Brad contested every legal document that came his way. Day after day, he had more delaying tactics. Finally, Gloria Parker, a legal assistant for the Snohomish County Prosecutor's Office, informed McKernan that Brad and his attorney were scheduled to appear in the Everett courtroom at 4 p.m. on March 25th and promised to do so if the court did not require them to bring the children. Brad knew the authorities were breathing down his neck. They had little doubt that he would, as he had told Dana, flee the country before he would submit himself or his sons to questioning. No way was he going to appear willingly in that courtroom in Everett, and if they didn't move fast, he and the boys would be on a plane to Chile or Mexico. On Thursday, March 25th, 1993, Scott Upham and investigators Jim Carr and Mike McKernan had reason, finally, to smile and to take a deep breath. Even without hearing Jess and Michael Cunningham's testimony, the grand jury had handed down a secret indictment charging Bradley Morris Cunningham with the murder of his wife, Cheryl Keaton, on September 21st, 1986. The jurors believed the testimony they had heard and stated their conclusion that Brad had killed his estranged wife by beating her on the head 21 times with an unknown blunt instrument. Now Upham and his team could get their arrest warrant, but their biggest fear was that Brad had somehow learned of the indictment and had already bolted and run, taking Jess, Michael, and Philip with him. They had done their best to keep a lid on the grand jury proceedings, and there was no news release on the indictment. Brad was aware the police were watching him, but maybe he didn't know they were now ready to move in on him. Brad had always been the stalker. He was now playing a completely different role. He was the one being stalked. McKernan flew to Washington before dawn to be sure he was in Everett when the arrest warrant arrived. Word was that Brad still had plenty of weapons. When the Mill Creek police checked back at the house where he had collected a virtual arsenal, they found almost every interior wall smashed. They speculated that Brad had been removing additional guns from their hiding places. Above all, McKernan wanted to facilitate a nonviolent arrest by working with authorities in Snohomish County. He contacted Captain Don Nelson of the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office, and Nelson assigned Sergeant Kevin Prentice to coordinate Brad's apprehension. It was 2:25 p.m. on March 25, 1993. The no-bail murder warrant, C-930434-CR, for the arrest of Brad Cunningham was entered into the NCIC, National Crime Information Center, computers. At 3:43 p.m., Jim Carr faxed a copy of the arrest warrant from Scott Upham's office in Hillsboro, Oregon. In the best of all worlds, Brad would show up at the courthouse in Everett at 4 p.m. as he had promised. At 4:20 p.m., Doug Purcell, the boy's attorney, arrived at the Snohomish courthouse without Brad. He said Brad had informed him he couldn't be there. He was in Burien, Washington, picking up items needed for a civil trial in Yakima the next day, and said he couldn't make this court appearance. At 4:45 p.m., McKernan spoke to a records clerk at Yakima County Superior Court. Brad's civil trial there, which involved his selling of properties that were legally in Cheryl Keaton's estate, had been rescheduled to April 16th, and all parties were informed, Brad included. At 7:45 p.m., McKernan observed the black Isuzu Trooper that Dana said was Brad's vehicle parked at Herman Dreesen's house. At 8:05 p.m., the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office SWAT team and McKernan gathered near Dreesen's house while Deputy David Vasconi stationed his patrol unit across the street so he could surveil the residence. The waiting lawman observed a Jeep Wagoneer and a new maroon sedan drive away. Mike McKernan couldn't help feeling nervous. What if they were watching Dreesen's house while Brad was boarding a plane for Chile? He knew how adept he was at slipping through police lines. At 9:31 p.m., Sergeant Tim Shea called the house using his cell phone. All he got was Dreesen's answering machine. At 9:41 p.m., Shea called the residence and spoke with Dreesen. Brad's uncle confirmed that he was inside the residence. Brad came on the line and was informed that the officers had a warrant for his arrest. "We request that you exit the house now. If you don't, we will obtain a search warrant and the SWAT team is coming in." Brad asked for more time. He said he would call the police mobile phone to let them know when he was coming out. Outside in the dark, officers had completely surrounded the perimeter of the residence. Minutes later, they saw a large white male come out of the back door and look around. Apparently spotting the waiting police, he turned and went back inside. At 10:03 p.m., Brad came out of the house accompanied by his uncle. Deputy Vasconi drove his patrol car to the front of the house and watched as Brad obeyed orders to put his hands up and walk slowly toward the patrol car. "When the suspect reached me," Vasconi wrote in his report, "I had him get down on his knees, at which time I placed him into handcuffs." Brad's arrest was almost anticlimactic. He had put up no fight at all. He hadn't even tried to run, not when he realized his uncle's property was alive with cops. He was searched for weapons and put into the back of the patrol car. Mike McKernan advised Brad of his rights under Miranda and asked if he would like to explain his side of the story. Brad looked at McKernan and said flatly, "I want to talk with my attorney." "Does that mean you don't want to talk to me? Ever?" McKernan asked. Brad simply repeated, "I want to talk to my attorney." That was no surprise to McKernan. He knew his prisoner had had almost as many attorneys as a law school graduating class. Their names and faces changed continually. Brad scarcely went to the bathroom without consulting an attorney. McKernan asked Dreesen if he might speak with Jess and Michael about what they remembered of the night their mother died, but Dreesen shook his head. "I would be bitterly opposed to you talking with the kids. If I could grab you by the neck and tell you don't hurt these kids, I would." The last thing in the world McKernan wanted to do was hurt Cheryl Keaton's children. On that matter, he was in complete agreement with Dreesen. But sometime, somehow, there had to be a way for the boys to release whatever was buried in their memories. Brad was driven to the Snohomish County Jail. On the way, he attempted to talk to Vasconi. "This has been hard on my children," he said. "I was going to come to the police department." "I don't want to talk to you," Vasconi said. For once, Brad shut up. He had plummeted a long, long way down from the successful bank executive and millionaire builder. On his knees, in handcuffs, silhouetted in the lights of police units, he hadn't made a very prepossessing picture. It had taken 6 years, 6 months, 4 days, and 2 hours, but he was finally facing criminal charges for Cheryl's vicious murder. The charge he was booked under was fugitive from justice. A bail hearing was held at 1 the next afternoon. Brad had retained yet another lawyer, James Tweedy, to oppose his extradition to Oregon. The hearing was conducted by video link-up between the jail where Brad was being held and Superior Court Judge Richard Thorpe's courtroom. During the course of the hearing, Brad interrupted the proceedings and asked to speak to his attorney. He then began a lengthy statement in which he essentially blamed the women in his life for his current predicament. He said that Dana Malloy had given him an Uzi as a gift. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had such a weapon. He said that he had lived with Dana for 3 years, that she was a stripper, and that he had finally broken up with her. All the charges coming out of Oregon were the fault of one of his former wives, Dr. Sarah Gordon. Brad suggested that both Dana and Sarah had set him up to seek revenge. Dana because he had left her, and Sarah because he was suing her for child support. As Brad watched the television image from his jail cell, Judge Thorpe set his bail. Brad always talked in millions, and his bail fit his lifestyle. $2.5 million. David Wold, a legal assistant in the Snohomish County Prosecutor's Office, said that he would have to post cash bail of $250,000 and post a security deposit for the remaining $2,250,000. Brad didn't have $250,000. A hearing was set for April 23rd when the court expected to review the bail and to consider extradition requests from Oregon. For the first time in his life, Brad was behind bars, dressed in jail-issue clothes, treated like a criminal. It's quite possible that he never really considered that such a thing might come to pass. McKernan made one more effort to talk with Brad before he returned to Oregon. He explained to James Tweedy that Brad had said repeatedly in television interviews and to newspaper reporters that all he wanted was a chance to tell his side of the story. McKernan was willing to listen. Tweedy reported back that his client had nothing to say to any representative of the Oregon State Police or the Washington County District Attorney's Office. Disappointed but not particularly surprised, McKernan headed home. Chapter 55. Jess, Michael, and Philip stayed with their father's recently widowed Uncle Herman. He had grown to love them, but caring for three young boys was a daunting task for Dreesen, who had a busy medical practice and no woman in the house to help. Moreover, he was still grieving for his kind, beautiful wife. Jess was 13, Michael was 11, and Philip was 9. Their mother had been dead for 6.5 years. They hadn't seen their adoptive mother, Sarah, for almost 3 years. Their Aunt Trudy was dead, too, and their temporary mother, Dana, was virtually gone from their lives. They had lived in Houston, Portland, Seattle, Linwood, and Canada, traveling continually. The central figure in their world was their father. He had seen to that. Now they had watched him kneeling in handcuffs and escorted to a patrol car by uniformed officers. Brad had been correct in his statement to Deputy David Vasconi. His arrest had been very hard on his children. Even so, Dreesen noticed that the boys were less reclusive and more animated after their father was out of the house. They had never dared speak back to him on any subject, but as Dreesen commented to another of Brad's relatives, "Once Brad was in jail and calling to talk with the boys, sometimes I've noticed that they actually disagree with him." Jess, Michael, and Philip were no longer the obedient automatons that Brad had programmed. They were brilliant young boys beginning to assert themselves, but they must have been terribly confused. Sarah Gordon read the news of Brad's arrest. The Oregonian headlined it, "Jury indicts man 6 years after murder." It confirmed what she had finally come to believe, that Brad had indeed murdered Cheryl. But she worried constantly about Jess, Michael, and Philip. She had managed to go on with her life. She had had no choice. Brad was suing her for child support, but he had made it impossible for her to see her sons. They had been little boys when they went away, and now Jess was in his teens. Sarah and Jack Kincaid had renewed their romance. He had been there for her when she needed someone solid, someone who told the truth. They were considering marriage and had purchased a secluded house that fronted on Lake Oswego. "I loved that house more than any other I've ever had," she would remember. They had been in their new home for 2 months when Brad was arrested. Brad's indictment meant that Sarah would again be in a witness chair for days of testimony. This time, Brad would be in the courtroom, and she knew he would instruct his attorneys to go for her throat. If that had to be, it had to be. but it was something she dreaded. She wasn't alone. Every other woman ever involved with Brad dreaded the thought of once more testifying against him. Their fear wasn't something they could explain, not to someone who hadn't lived through it. Sarah had never had children of her own, and Jack had raised his two. They had planned a life without children, although Sarah knew she would always miss the sons she had been allowed to have for only a short time. But now Brad's arrest meant that Jess, Michael, and Philip, by law, might be returned to her. Sarah was their legal mother, and she wanted them back. But she wanted to be sure they were comfortable with her. She had no idea what Brad might have told them in the last 3 years. She had listened to their angry voices yelling at her on the phone, heard Brad coaching them in the background. For all she knew, her sons might be completely brainwashed by now and consider her the ultimate enemy, the real cause of their father's downfall. Sarah got in touch with Herm Dreesen, and they talked about what would be best for the boys. The weekend after Brad's arrest, Betty and Marv Trosseth and Sarah and Jack went up to Dreesen's house to see Jess and Michael and Philip. They moved very gently and very slowly. They had some idea what the boys had been through, and they knew the boys were seeing relatives they hadn't been allowed any contact with for years, relatives their father had told them were dangerous and evil. Ever so slowly, the ice melted. Sarah had never been anything but loving to her sons, and they began to remember that. They began to remember Mom, and they began to remember their grandmother, Betty Trosseth. "Every weekend after that," Sarah said, "I went up to Linwood to spend time with them. Herm and I agreed that they should finish the school year up there, but that it would be best if they came back to live with me and Jack." Brad continued to fight extradition to Washington County, Oregon. He was finally transported to Hillsboro and arraigned on murder charges on May 6, 1993, in the county where Cheryl had died. On June 6th, Brad pleaded not guilty to murder charges. If Jess, Michael, and Philip hadn't gone to live with Sarah, they would probably have been placed in a foster home. It was their decision, and they picked Sarah. But it was not going to be an easy road. On June 22, 1993, Sarah and Jack drove to Linwood and brought the boys home to Lake Oswego. By that time, they had come to a decision about their relationship. The future they had planned together had to take a back seat to Sarah's sons. Sarah and I had finally gotten to the point where most of the financial messes Brad created were resolved or under control, Kincaid remembered. We had a great life together, and it looked even brighter, despite the lingering concern about Brad's continued legal harassment and some issues of personal safety. Bingo. Brad gets arrested. Because I knew it wouldn't work with me living in the same home as Brad's three children, Sarah leased a home for herself and the boys, where she lives at this time. Obviously, this has taken a toll on our relationship, but not on our friendship. Sarah had made her choice, the only choice she felt she could make. Jack stayed in the house on the lake for a while. They still saw each other, but it wasn't the same. Brad was rapidly running out of family to support him, both emotionally and financially. Herm Dreesen finally realized that he was merely an expedient to his nephew. That was brought home loud and clear when Brad assumed his uncle would pay for criminal defense lawyers and referred prospective attorneys to Dr. Dreesen. Estimating conservatively, a murder defense was going to cost $200,000. Dreesen had backed Brad for years now, given him and his children a home, advanced money to him, tried to get a building project started, but there was no way he could afford legal fees like that. With his refusal to guarantee Brad's legal expenses, his Uncle Herm became another one of Brad's enemies. He told the court that he was indigent. The state of Oregon would have to provide him with an attorney. But as always, he would continue to go through attorneys the way a hot knife cuts through butter. Chapter 56. Sarah hired a nanny to be with Jess, Michael, and Philip when she was at the hospital. She was happy to see that they were all accomplished on the Mac computer that Brad had bought them, and that they still loved sports. They began to rebuild their lives together, steadily narrowing the emotional distance that 3 years had wrought. Sarah signed the boys up for tennis, baseball, and basketball, and chauffeured them around herself. She went to every one of their games she could. Jess loved to fish. Michael, who was the image of Cheryl, had a great sense of humor, and Philip had real talent as a cartoonist. At first, Philip's drawings were mostly black on black, but gradually he began to use yellow crayons, flooding his work with sunshine. Meanwhile, as Brad awaited trial, Sarah had little sunshine in her life beyond her sons. She was under almost constant siege, by phone and by mail, from the man who gave his return address as Cunningham Dad, Washington County Jail, 146 Northeast Lincoln Street, Hillsboro, Oregon. Brad addressed his letters to Cunningham, or Cunningham Boys, /3. The envelopes were decorated with cartoons demeaning Sarah, and with pornographic references to Jack, whom Brad had dubbed the infamous Lake Oswego Weasel, Mr. GQ. Brad had always related to his sons in an oddly demarcated manner. He demanded absolute and unquestioning obedience from them because he was their father, and yet he often treated them as peers, as small adults whom he dragged into press conferences and discussions that would be terribly upsetting to any child. Sarah was trying to protect them now, but Brad did everything he could to undermine her. He phoned his sons often, and Sarah accepted the collect calls. But it was soon obvious that Brad was telling his sons outrageous lies about her. She didn't cut off his phone contact with the boys, but she informed Brad in writing that she would be taping his calls and monitoring what was said. It scarcely slowed Brad down. He told the boys they would be better off in a foster home than living with Sarah. He said she was a lesbian who hated men, and you are little men. He berated them for calling her mom after all she's done. He suggested to his sons that Sarah was giving them drugs. Sarah was trying to follow counselor's advice. She didn't want to cut the boys off completely from their father. But understandably, she didn't want them to listen to a steady stream of propaganda against her either. It was hard to find a middle ground. Brad's first state-appointed attorney was Timothy Dunn. Dunn was a capable attorney, but he was a mild-mannered man, and his client would find fault with almost everything he did. Even in court appearances, it was soon obvious to spectators that Brad intended to run the show. He was always tugging at Dunn's sleeve or whispering in his ear. The first real skirmish in what would prove to be a long, long road to a criminal verdict took place in Judge Alan C. Bonebrake's courtroom 309C in the historic Washington County Courthouse on August 24, 1993. Brad was seeking to be released from jail on bail pending his criminal trial. Not surprisingly, Scott Upham wanted Cunningham kept inside the Washington County Jail. If ever a defendant had shown a tendency to disappear, it was this one. Only a handful of spectators waited on benches outside Judge Bonebrake's courtroom. Mike Shinn was there, Betty and Marv Trosseth, Jim Carr, Jack Kincaid, a few reporters. It might well have been a simple traffic or domestic dispute hearing for all the interest Brad's bail hearing aroused. A broad-shouldered man dressed in a dark suit, probably an attorney from the look of him, approached the courtroom door. He was carrying a huge file, and he had to juggle it as he tried to turn the knob. He scrupulously ignored the others waiting to get in. Only on a closer look were the handcuffs on his wrists apparent. It was Brad. He wasn't alone. He was followed by two court officers, J.C. Crossland, a huge man who stood 6'7" and weighed a good 250 pounds, and a slender female security officer. Their eyes never left Brad. He moved into the courtroom easily. If he was embarrassed or felt diminished by his restraints, he didn't show it. The bail hearing would take more than 4 days, as long as most trials. Scott Upham gave an overview of his case and presented more than 25 witnesses. The small gallery saw a mini-trial, the cliff notes of the real trial to come. Featuring a parade of witnesses beginning with paramedic Tom Duffy and ending with Oregon State Police criminalist Julia Hinckley, the proceedings were fascinating, intense, and comprehensive. A handful of attractive women who had once loved Brad took the witness stand. They answered Upham's questions, but almost reluctantly, offering no more than they were asked. One spectator commented later in the hallway, "You know why they're not talking, don't you? They're scared to death he may be getting out on bail." Defense attorney Tim Dunn argued that the state had no direct evidence linking his client to Cheryl Keaton's murder, and that witnesses' memories had become so faulty with the passage of time that they gave conflicting statements. On Friday, August 27, 1993, however, Judge Bonebrake ruled that Upham had met the state's burden of proof in presenting evidence to show why Brad should be held over for trial without bail. The first trial date was set for January 1994, but Brad had fired Dunn as his attorney and could not, of course, proceed. He needed time for his new attorneys to get up to speed on his case, and there were voluminous files for them to go through. His new court-appointed attorneys were two of the best criminal defense attorneys in the state of Oregon, Tim Lyons and J. Kevin Hunt. Hunt was an expert on DNA and a superior researcher, and Lyons was smooth, sharp, and quick on his feet. Hunt was an intense young man who rarely smiled. Lyons was more laid back and smiled often. There was a scheduling problem. In fact, there were to be problems month after month. Hearings would be set and postponed. Lyons was involved with another murder trial in which the victim was a small child. It was impossible for him to know when he could go to trial with Brad. An omnibus hearing was on the docket for June 6th, put off until June 14th, and then rescheduled for July 5th. Omnibus hearings take place before the trial itself to give both sides a chance to bring up issues that concern them and may be ruled on before the trial begins. In many trials, it saves time. No one could yet have any idea how time-consuming Brad's legal maneuverings would be. As the weeks passed, Brad continued to bombard Sarah's home with letters and phone calls. He knew that his calls and letters were being monitored and that Sarah had informed Judge Bonebrake that she was going to do so to protect the boys. Brad rarely failed to complain about that on the envelopes. One envelope had a cartoon of a rabbit. The balloon over its head read, "And I thought I had big ears." Another cartoon of a child talking into the phone read, "You mean she's still doing it? Man, she's either a straight-up freak or dominantly stupid." Beneath the phone, Brad had printed, "Tap, tap, tap." Most of the envelope's cartoons had to do with sex, vibrators, batteries, and sexual toys most fathers wouldn't discuss with pre-adolescent boys. For years, Brad had kept his sons continually on the move to be reassured that they would not testify at a grand jury hearing or in a trial. He was doing his best now to continue influencing them through phone calls and letters. In June 1994, with his trial date scheduled for August, he hand-printed a 4-page letter to Jess, Michael, and Philip. a document full of outrageous lies that detailed for them how he was being unjustly persecuted by a crooked prosecution team and, of course, by Sarah. Brad had once blamed Mike Shinn, John Burke, Betty Trosseth, and Sarah Gordon for the problems in his life. Now he included Scott Upham as a scheming co-conspirator. Never since her death had Brad referred to Cheryl as the boy's mom, and he didn't in this letter. Brad wrote to tell his sons to remember that Cheryl died clutching a small wad of hair in her hand. It was determined that the hair was not my hair, and the hair was not necessarily hers. Not true. Scott Upham, Sarah's co-conspirator, will not further test the hair and will not let me see it to do a DNA test. Not true. He told his sons that your mother had a date with a policeman, Finch, who later investigated her homicide. This is the same police officer who interviewed each of you days after her death and totally destroyed my life and work career by his actions and statements. This was also untrue, but the affair with Jerry Finch's story would become one of Brad's favorite red herrings in his upcoming trial. Brad wrote to his sons that their dead mother was a cocaine user, that his attorneys were not permitted to look at bloody handprints in the van, that the crime scene had been deliberately contaminated by Jerry Finch, and that all manner of evidence had been deliberately destroyed, again by Jerry Finch. He discussed his own sexual liaisons quite openly and accused Sarah once again of being a bisexual. That his intended audience was aged 13, 11, and 9 didn't cause him to hold anything back. "We have reason to believe you boys have been tampered with, too," he wrote. "Either drugs or hypnosis. We think Sarah and Upham have tried memory alteration or implantation techniques. We think Sarah, Upham, are using memory therapy wherein they, through a hypnotist, are planting, by suggestion, new memories into your minds. Sarah will punish me, hurt me, cause me to be found guilty of a crime I had nothing to do with. She wants to inflict great hurt and harm upon your dad in retaliation for my having an affair with Lynn. We have some leads she is paying off people. Jack is involved. And there's more." Dr. Ron Turco had described Brad as being a prime example of malignant narcissism, and his messages to his sons seemed to verify that diagnosis. He had always treated them as his possessions, and he needed them now to be his alibi witnesses for his movements on the night their mother was murdered. He had finally accepted the fact that whether he wanted to or not, he was going to trial. Chapter 57. Brad vacillated between wanting a speedy trial and doing whatever he could to delay it. He was frustrated by his belief that Tim Lyons was not giving him enough time for conferences. He didn't like the Washington County Jail and demanded to be moved to another facility. He told Judge Bonebreak that prisoners were hiding cigarettes and matches in the jail ceiling and creating a fire hazard. He feared for his life and asked to be moved to safer quarters. He did not approve of the alternate jails that were suggested, however, and he remained in the Washington County Jail. His betrayal of his fellow prisoners did not go unnoticed. The lowest creature in any penal institution is a snitch, and Brad was a constant snitch. In grade school, he would have been called a tattletale. In jail or prison, the revenge against a snitch may not come swiftly, but it always comes. William Berrigan was the commander of the Washington County Jail, and Brad was not one of his favorite prisoners. During Brad's 18-month stay, he would be disciplined 11 times and spend 6 months in lockdown in a 6-by-9-foot cell. He wrote to the FBI and asked for an investigation of the jail because he felt his civil rights were being violated. At his July 5th omnibus hearing, Brad was represented by Tim Lyons and Kevin Hunt. This time he was dressed in the traditional faded orange pajama-like jail uniform. His hands were cuffed, his legs were shackled. His complexion had taken on the yellowish jail pallor that all long-time prisoners have, but his shoulders and biceps were buffed. He had obviously been working out in his cell. He carried his omnipresent box of files, and his confidence hadn't diminished at all. This was to be the only time when Tim Lyons could truly act as Brad's attorney, and his expertise was apparent. Since so much of the evidence was circumstantial, it was quite possible that Lyons could win an acquittal, but Brad treated him as he had all his other attorneys. He had to be in charge, and he leaned against Lyons constantly, mouthing directions. He pushed notes across the polished defense table, tapping his finger to get Lyons' attention. Lyons often pulled away from his client. The defense hit hard at the long delay in issuing the criminal indictment and asked what new evidence the state had. Most of all, they wanted to have any statements Cheryl had made just before her death banned from the criminal trial. They also sought Upham's work products in preparation for the trial and during his investigation. Judge Bonebrake would not allow that and would delay his ruling on whether Cheryl's statements and notes were hearsay or excited utterances. If Upham could get into the trial Cheryl's statements made to her mother minutes before she died and the note she wrote to her brother, he would breathe easier. There was new evidence. DNA analysis had come into its own since 1986, and OSP criminalist Julia Hinckley had retained the hairs found on Cheryl's body. There was more witness testimony, too. But the most important testimony, if Judge Bonebrake would allow it, would be from a woman dead for 8 years. The victim. Brad's next trial date, August 29, 1994, was postponed. Lyons was representing another murder defendant, and Brad complained that neither of his attorneys was available for conferences with him when he felt it was necessary. His phone calls were not returned quickly enough. He abruptly fired J. Kevin Hunt and Tim Lyons and announced that he would represent himself. Brad felt completely capable of handling his own defense. Even though he was not an attorney, he certainly was conversant with the law, with attorneys, with courtrooms, and with all manner of suits. He had had his own office at Vincent & Elkins' law firm in Houston whenever he wanted it during the years his suit in Texas dragged on. But he had no experience with a criminal trial and had never gone to law school. And even if he had, the old saw that almost anyone can quote is, "He who defends himself has a fool for a client." But nothing and no one could dissuade him from taking the reins of his own defense. Once he had dispensed with his lawyers, Brad went after Judge Alan Bonebrake. He couldn't legally fire a judge, but he did the next best thing. He sued him, claiming Bonebrake had violated his civil rights. Now that Bonebrake had personal legal matters pending with the defendant, he felt he couldn't serve as an impartial judge. He recused himself. Judge Timothy Alexander replaced him. But if Bonebrake had been an implacable brick wall whom he detested, Brad would soon find that he had unwittingly placed himself in front of a judge who not only had an encyclopedic knowledge of the laws of Oregon, but who had almost no patience with defendants' histrionics and diversionary tactics. Alexander would carefully explain pitfalls to the defense, but once he had given his warning, he was not pleased to have to repeat it again and again and again. Outside the courtroom, Tim Alexander had a great sense of humor. Inside, he had virtually none. With 20 years' experience as a trial lawyer, Scott Upham was confident that, facing even as savvy a layman as Brad Cunningham one-on-one, he could make mincemeat of him. but Upham shuddered at the thought of the circus Brad could create if he was allowed to represent himself. There is an order and a sequence to the law. Brad knew nothing of that. Even law school graduates rarely venture into criminal law until they have been in practice for 5 years or more. Brad's defending himself was going to be a little like a first-year medical student performing open-heart surgery. Brad didn't know the rules. He didn't know the procedures. He didn't know the language. He didn't know the techniques, and he would probably turn what should be an orderly progression of witnesses, evidence, and arguments into utter chaos. Of all people concerned, Upham hoped that Brad could be dissuaded from being a one-man show, that he would be opposing a real attorney and not a man who had demonstrated throughout his life that he had to be in charge. But Brad was adamant that he would defend himself, although he grudgingly agreed to allow the state of Oregon to retain Hunt and Lyons as his legal advisors, if not as his attorneys. He himself would select the jury, question witnesses, and present his own arguments. He would be the voice, but he would have Lyons and Hunt next to him to consult on issues where he had ventured out of his depth. The trial that had been first scheduled for January of 1994 was set over from August to October 24th, and then to October 26th. Main Street in Hillsborough was decorated for Halloween when the trial began at last. 9 months after it was supposed to. Estimates were that it would last 2 weeks. When it finally ended, the jack-o'-lanterns were long since gone, snow covered the Washington County Courthouse grounds, and Main Street was decorated for Christmas. Part 7. The Criminal Trial. Chapter 58. Brad's initial bail hearing 14 months before had been held in the old section of the Washington County Courthouse. On the fourth floor of the newer addition, two elevators open onto a corridor with a huge woven wall hanging done in peach, orange, and blue tones that greets everyone who emerges with the motto, "Where law ends, tyranny begins." John Locke. Every spectator heading for the two courtrooms on the fourth floor has to pass through highly sensitive metal detectors. Nothing metal gets through. No pocket knives, no hat pins, no nail files, no church keys, no jokes. Judge Alexander's courtroom had only 3 rows of chairs for the gallery, and when Brad's trial began, the back row was almost entirely filled with Cheryl's family. They had been through this too many times before, but this was the trial that might finally give them some closure. It would not be easy for them, but they would commute every day of the trial from Longview in the hours before dawn and after sunset. Betty and Marv Trosseth, Susan and Dave Keegan, Bob McNanny, Jim Carr, and Cheryl's cousin, Katana King. Her half-sisters and their husbands flew up from California to be present, Debbie and Billy Bowen and Kim and Bill Roberts. So many people had been involved with Cheryl's life and with her death. Mike Shinn would often be in the courtroom, as would Sarah's friend and protector Jack Kincaid, a presence that particularly rankled Brad. There would always be a line at the metal detectors, and, except for the media and family, seating would be scarce. Portland network affiliate cameramen, radio and television field reporters, an occasional syndicated tabloid television producer from Los Angeles, even a reporter from the London Guardian would wander in and out. The constant media presences, however, were Fiona Ortiz and Robin Franzen from the Oregonian, Laurie Smith from the Daily News in Longview, Eric Epilategi from the Hillsborough Angus, and this author and her assistant. Every trial takes on a life of its own, and this one, more than any other, would have a strangeness and, indeed, the chaotic propulsion that Upham had feared. There was always the sense that, had it not been for Judge Alexander, it might hurtle off the track at any moment. No one could ever really know what the defendant would do next. As the trial got underway, Upham was as low-key and inscrutable as his opponent was volatile. Brad was once again dressed in a neat dark suit. He had a fresh haircut, combed so that it mostly hid an encroaching bald spot at the crown of his very large head. His handcuffs were always removed outside the courtroom so the jury would not see them, but he wore a brace on his left leg, a bulky anti-escape device that extended from his ankle to well above his knee. Brad had asked that he always be in place at the lectern from which he spoke to the jurors before they came in, so they wouldn't know about the brace. Judge Alexander acceded to that request. Next, Brad said he needed glasses. He couldn't read all his files. He had headaches and his eyes blurred. Sighing, Judge Alexander acceded to that request, too, but wondered why Brad's attorneys, or rather his legal advisors, hadn't seen to this a long time ago. Over the weekend, Brad would be taken to the Oregon Health Sciences facilities to get glasses. Because he was escorted there in his orange jail scrubs, he complained when the trial resumed that a potential juror might have seen him in there. It was startling to hear Brad speak. He had a rather high, almost boyish voice. He didn't sound in the least violent. He smiled pleasantly when he said yet again, "Motion to continue." "Denied." Brad glanced around the courtroom, and his eyes fell on Cheryl's family in the back row. He asked that potential witnesses be barred from the courtroom. "We're not going to play that game," Alexander said calmly. In Oregon, survivors of crime victims have the right by law to be present in the courtroom, whether they are to be witnesses or not. It was time to pick a jury. During voir dire, the opposing attorneys could rather informally ask questions of those in the jury pool when they filed into the jury box three at a time. Brad had difficulty asking simple questions and continually lapsed into conversation with potential jurors, almost as if he felt he had to convince them now of his innocence. When Judge Alexander chastised him, Brad smiled and said, "I've never done this before." "This is very important to me. It's my life," was another of Brad's frequent comments. As indeed it was. He wasn't facing the death penalty, but the hedonistic freedom he had enjoyed his whole life would end if he lost this most important courtroom battle. Brad's arguments, however, weren't what Judge Alexander wanted to hear on voir dire. "Mr. Cunningham, I haven't heard a question yet," he said. "If you don't ask one, I'll move on to Mr. Upham." Brad was a quick study. He asked the potential jurors questions about their jobs, background, family, children, possible divorces, custody battles. Again and again he asked, "Do you wonder why I'm defending myself? Does it bother you?" They all wondered. It bothered none of them. When Upham asked a question of a potential juror that drew a meaningful response, such as, "Have you heard of winning at all costs?" Brad appropriated that question for the next trio of possible jurors. "Does it concern you that someone is indigent?" he asked one juror. Upham objected, and Alexander sustained. It became quickly apparent that Brad wanted to begin trying his case with jurors who hadn't even been chosen yet. His voir dire questions centered around crooked cops, frame-ups, the plight of the indigent defendant, the loose morals of the victim, and the length of time between the murder and his trial. To his credit, Judge Alexander would spend much of the trial giving short lectures to Brad on law. At this point, he explained what voir dire of jurors was supposed to be, adding, "Mr. Cunningham, it takes years to understand this sophisticated process." Alexander likened Brad to a first-year law student and reminded him to ask questions that elicited only the facts of the jurors' lives. Brad had taken 2 hours on 3 jurors. "You have 10 minutes to finish, Mr. Cunningham," Alexander warned. The prospective jurors often seemed intimidated by Brad. He asked them to define affidavit and deposition and other legal terms. Most of them could not. And when they couldn't answer, or the answer was not what he wanted to hear, Brad was unfailingly calm and smiled, saying softly, "Okay." He asked about vendettas and people who lie to fit the facts, and entrepreneurs and poisoning the well and burden of proof. But his most revealing questions were about what a potential juror might think of him. "How about someone who blames someone else for all their problems?" he asked one juror. And another, "How about women who collect men as prizes?" No way was this trial going to be finished in 2 weeks. With Brad's tedious questioning of prospective jurors, it took until 10 minutes after 2 on November 8, 1994, for both sides to agree on 12 jurors. Although 2 alternates would be chosen soon after, 13 days had passed and opening arguments were still ahead. Upham was sanguine. His theory on juries was that almost any combination of personalities would make a functional jury. He was satisfied with this one, balanced equally between males and females, youth and age, professional and blue-collar. He had lost some he would have liked, particularly a young paramedic who he knew would never survive the defense's challenges. All in all, it was a good jury. But Upham had much more to be confident about. In pre-trial rulings, he had won the most important witness he could possibly have, Cheryl. Her last note to Jim Carr was in. Her last call to her mother was in. The jury would hear about those final hopeless cries for help. Judge Alexander ruled that they were not hearsay, but rather akin to deathbed statements. Cheryl Keaton, one of the most brilliant young attorneys in the Northwest, dead too soon, would testify in this trial. And if Brad was both the defendant and the defense attorney, then Cheryl would be both the victim and the star witness. On Monday afternoon, November 14th, Judge Alexander's courtroom was packed so tightly that the sacrosanct first row of seats, heretofore kept empty of spectators, was grudgingly open to the press. Reporters were allowed to sit in the first row, except for the 4 seats directly behind the defense table. They all knew why. The premise was that Brad might try to escape and use a reporter seated directly behind him as a hostage, a soap opera scenario perhaps, but one policy that all courtrooms adhere to. For the same reason, murder defendants never have wheels on their chairs. It would be too easy to spin around and sprint for a door or window. Brad was certainly no ordinary defendant. He wore his 2 hats proudly. There were television cameras aimed directly at him, and he almost basked in their strobe lights. He was no longer sleeping in a jail cell. The Washington County Jail had provided him with a 3-room suite, part of the infirmary, all to himself. He was now housed alone in part so he could study his files late, and in part because he was the least popular prisoner in the jail. He had a television, but he complained that he had no facts. He also complained that his lights weren't bright enough. In addition to his suit against his last judge, Brad was suing the jail. He was as litigious a defendant as most reporters had ever seen, and the most quarrelsome. As the trial began, he objected to Upham's exhibits, maps, and photos. He moved for a mistrial because Judge Alexander walked out of the courtroom before Brad had presented his motion asking to be present at the jury's on-site viewing of the crime scene earlier that morning. "We ruled on that weeks ago, Mr. Cunningham," Alexander said implacably. Had Brad realized yet that he had forced one judge to recuse himself, only to place himself squarely in the eye of a man as obdurate as he was himself? Apparently not. And even if he had the legal lingo down, he didn't understand much more criminal law than any neophyte. He said that Alexander's rulings were arbitrary and capricious. He moved again for a mistrial. He didn't know that he had to submit such requests in writing. Upham did. Brad didn't. "We won't spend time retreading old ground," Alexander said sternly. "Don't waste my time." Brad objected to the microphone on his table. It had no kill button. "It's a public courtroom, Mr. Cunningham." Brad had still more complaints. He said that Scott Upham had lied about how long the trial would last, and that Upham had deliberately kept good jurors out by saying that the trial would take so long. "Sit down, Mr. Cunningham," Judge Alexander said. Brad remained standing. "Sit down." No one had ever really told Brad what to do. Alexander went further. If there were any more delays, any more games, he would throw Brad out of the courtroom. "Bring the jury in." If ever two men were opposites, it was Scott Upham and Brad Cunningham. Upham was low-key, quietly confident, almost businesslike in his refusal to become emotional in the courtroom. He began his opening arguments at 1:47 p.m., He explained to the jury that they would have evidence to consider in two forms, the sworn testimony of witnesses and exhibits. He encouraged them to take notes and to remember that his own opening statement was not evidence. "What Mr. Cunningham says is not evidence." Upham detailed the charges against Brad. He stood accused of intentionally causing the death of another human being. The question the jurors must decide was quite simple. Did Bradley Morris Cunningham bludgeon Cheryl Keaton to death on September 21, 1986? Then, in his steady, deep voice, Upham told the story, the tragedy, really, of Cheryl's and Brad's lives. All the marriages, all the divorces, the births of their children. Cheryl's steadfast emotional and financial support, Brad's million-dollar projects and the collapse of his financial empire, the faltering of their marriage. For reporters and witnesses who had committed to memory the horrific end of that marriage, there were no surprises, only admiration for Upham's precise memory of every detail, every date, all the diminishing highs of Cheryl's life and the accelerating lows. For months, Upham had sat up late, reviewing literally a roomful of files until he probably knew Cheryl Keaton's life better than he recalled events and dates of his own life. What were the jurors thinking? Had they ever heard a story of stalking and terror like this one, outside of a movie theater? No one could tell. All jurors quickly developed poker faces. They stare at the prosecution and defense alike without expression. They look at photographs that show horrors they could never have imagined and pass them on down the line. Only courtroom amateurs say they know what jurors are thinking. No one knows. Rarely do opposing